Morrow gets a lot of credit, quite deservedly, for being the one who finally really stood up and used the power of television to go after McCarthy. And he did it at great risk to his own career. His employer, CBS, was not really happy about this, but he was quite forthright, and he, made sure that his case was airtight.
Clay, welcome to the Golden Age.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you are the author of Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. What made you want to write it?
So, I'd written a couple other books about sort of mid-century post-war American political history, and that's sort of just also generally a topic that I'm interested in. And so in researching and writing and reading, it struck me that the Red Scare, this period of anti-communist hysteria after the war, was almost like this dark matter that existed around so many other stories and sort of shaped so many other stories of foreign policy, civil rights history, what have you. And even when it wasn't explicit, it was there. And so what interested me was just kind of the desire, the curiosity to go explore that and to kind of give shape to it, really out of my own sense of interest, but also because I thought, well, that would be a good way to help other people understand sort of this, the nature of post-war American history in a broader sense, and how a lot of different parts of that were shaped by this one moment.
And you write about McCarthyism and the Red Scare almost as if it was what we would describe as a culture war today. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, my argument, it originally started with a question, which was, why did this happen? Why did the Red Scare take place when it did? And why did it take the shape that it did? And obviously, the onset of the Cold War was a big part of that, and security concerns about Soviet espionage. But, those were not unique to the United States, and lots of countries had those issues. I also felt like there had to be something more. And so my argument is that really what the Red Scare was in large part a kind of delayed fight over this sort of progressive versus conservative ideals left over from the 1930s. That with the onset of the New Deal in the 1930s and this sort of cultural front, popular front moment where lots of people rallied around the left broadly. And a lot of people opposed it. But that fight was fairly subsumed by the Depression and the popularity of Franklin Roosevelt and then World War II. And so it's only after World War II and the onset of the Cold War and this demand for total security and really, fear of another war, that this cultural conflict not only reignites, but takes on a resonance and a vehemence that it never had before, and it's in the form of the Red Scare.
And was that fear warranted? Were there actually Soviet spies in the US?
Well, there certainly were, and I would say, whether the fear was warranted to the extent that it manifested itself, I think it was overblown. But there certainly were reasons to be concerned about Soviet espionage. There were spies, and many of them were caught eventually, but many of them weren't actually. We still don't know everybody. The Communist Party in the United States was, in some respects, at some levels, a bad actor. Was not interested in certainly democratic principles, but also was taking its cues and funding from Moscow, and so there was reasons to be concerned about that. But none of that justifies the scale and scope and particular shape of the Red Scare.
And so President Truman signs via executive order the Federal Employee Loyalty Program into being. And why did he do that? What was the message that he was trying to send?
I think there were sort of two things he was trying to do. On the one hand, he was trying to defuse a situation which was growing within the federal government, and particularly from the FBI and from more conservative elements of his party, really raising the temperature on fears of communist infiltration again, which were not completely unwarranted. And so Truman thought, well, this would be a good way to kind of diffuse that, to make it look like I'm doing something. You know, this came right after the 1946 midterms, where the Democrats were absolutely shellacked and, you know, were to some extent a referendum on Truman's presidency so far. And so he really felt like he needed to take a stand. You know, in his view, this was a minor policy. It wasn't going to have much of an effect. But the other thing that he wanted to do was to really, and this sounds sort of contradictory, but was to raise concerns about communism globally. He was committing to spending, you know, billions of dollars to support Greek anti-communists, to support the Marshall Plan, to support anti-communism in Europe, to eventually build NATO. And, you know, the public needed to have something to rally around. And so in a way, Truman was sort of playing with fire. He thought he could control it. He later admitted that he made a huge mistake, and that the loyalty program was not only got it out of hand in itself, but also helped catalyze the Red Scare.
And so why did Senator McCarthy launch these hearings, and who was Senator McCarthy?
So Joseph McCarthy in 1950 was 4 years into his first 6-year term as senator. He was kind of a backbencher. He was not very well respected, even among the Republican Party. He was sort of someone who just didn't fit in with the norms and mores of the Senate. But he was, you know, looking for an issue. And he was always strongly anti-communist. And there were elements of the McCarthy we sort of know as this bomb thrower. You know, there are elements of that long before he came to the national attention. But it was in early 1950, right as a number of trials, anti-communist trials, were coming to a head, that he decided to make that his signature issue. And he did it in a way that no one else had up until that point, really, or with, let's say, a vehemence and a disregard for fact that most other people had at least walked lightly around. He was willing to, you know, make all sorts of bald and untrue accusations, to really just go where no one else in the Senate was willing to go. And it was hard for reporters to keep up with him. It was hard for other senators to keep up with him. You know, he did a lot of things that wrecked Senate norms. And the public, for a time, loved him. They loved what he was doing. And he became the center of American politics.
Was this a path for power for him? Or did he truly fear communism in the U.S.?
Well, I think it was somewhere in between. You know, it's hard to know. I don't think McCarthy ever wanted more power. I think it was more like he picked up this issue as a way to give himself some credibility, not knowing that it would take off quite the way it did. And then, you know, he essentially rode that rocket without any real plan of where it would go. He never had presidential aspirations. He was never someone who really had a plan in place. He never talked about what he would do with all this power that he had, except to continue doing what he was doing. And I think, you know, in some ways he, yeah, found himself on a vehicle, on a, you know, rocket, or call it a runaway horse, that he couldn't jump off of, but he also didn't really want to jump off of, because he was going fast. And just to extend that metaphor as far as I can, you know, he probably knew at the back of his mind that it was going to end badly, but there was really nothing he could do except take advantage of the moment.
And he poured fuel on these conspiracy theories that communism had infiltrated all sorts of aspects of American life. Can you talk to me about the power of the conspiracy theory and how we should think about it today?
Yeah, well, one of the things about the Red Scare is just how much the conspiracy theory as an idea, there were many conspiracy theories at the time, but this concept that, you know, there's a hidden story behind, there's a real truth behind the falsehoods or the so-called truth that you're being fed. And this went back to the 1930s, or I mean, really in American history, it goes long back before that. But, you know, what picked up in the late 40s, and certainly McCarthy made a lot of hay about it, is this idea that the federal government and governments at all levels were in the throes of a secret radical left cabal that was destroying America from the inside, and that the media was in on it, the military was in on it, all centers of power were in on it, except for the people who revealed it, right? And this could be a senator like McCarthy, it could be there were any number of journalists out there who kind of played with this. And I want to be clear, not every anti-communist was a conspiracy theorist, and many of them were responsible people. But the ones who were leading the charge of the Red Scare were by and large the ones who played into this conspiracy theory and told people that, you know, their way of life was under threat from the government. And, you know, it is one of the things that stuck around. I mean, people, you can say, well, they came to their senses after the Red Scare or, you know, by the late 50s, but it remained salient for a large number of people. Largely on the right. And, you know, I think to this day is still one of the dominating ideas of the hard right in America.
And what was the real world impact of these hearings and these conspiracy theories? I mean, many people went to jail, right? Especially in Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, you can enumerate a long list of impacts, starting with the fact that, yeah, a lot of people went to jail. They went to jail for
contempt of Congress,
for contempt of Congress. Right, right. They went to jail for, you know, contempt of court at varying, you know, lower levels. And this was not because they did anything wrong. They just refused to play the game that that the House Un-American Activities Committee wanted them to play. You know, an untold number of people, thousands of people lost their jobs or had their job. Their careers derailed because of questions about their loyalty. And it should be noted that none of these programs, none of these efforts ever caught anybody. The spies that were caught were all caught by traditional law enforcement, by the FBI. HUAC and these, you know, varying you know, Senate committees, McCarthy, state and local committees, they never found anybody. There were no communist spies in, say, the LA sewer district, which was one place where they cracked down. So, you know, but there was also, I mean, there are other impacts that go beyond the individual. I mean, there are any number of people who didn't join government because of the fear that they would be somehow punished for their beliefs. There was a restricting of free speech and thought. People just simply didn't express themselves the way that they might have otherwise. This also manifested itself in our foreign policy. Many people in the State Department lost their jobs largely because they had different views about, say, the Chinese Civil War. And it's not that they were pro-communist, but maybe they thought Mao and the Chinese communists were someone we could work with. But the end result of this is that for decades afterward, people in policymaking positions were afraid to express different opinions. And you can see how that impacted our foreign policy leading up to Vietnam, our foreign policy during other parts of the Cold War. This is why these sorts of moments are really dangerous.
And beyond government, it, as I mentioned, impacted Hollywood. Can you tell me about the Hollywood 10 and the Blacklist?
Yeah. So the Hollywood 10, this was one of the first major episodes of the Red Scare, and it's when, you know, 10 screenwriters, producers, directors were called in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee and demanded they reveal their beliefs about communism or membership in unions, and they refused to play along. They went to jail for contempt of Congress. Even before they went to jail, the various studio heads got together and said, look, these people will never work in Hollywood again until they tell the truth. Furthermore, anybody else who is even suspected of harboring similar beliefs will also not work in Hollywood. And this is what became the Blacklist. And sometimes people were blacklisted because they explicitly refused to talk to Congress. In other cases, it was simply out of based on rumors. You know, someone heard that someone had once been on a project with a communist and they got to be friends. Right? They were the ridiculous stories of guilt by association. The studios were so afraid of what could happen, of public animosity, protests, and losing market share, that they were gun shy and basically refused to work with people who had any so-called taint about them.
And you're a writer for the New York Times. I'm curious how the press held up during the Red Scare. Obviously, Edward R. Murrow was a big force against McCarthyism. Can you talk about Murrow and maybe other press figures who stood up and how they fared?
Yeah, I mean, Murrow gets a lot of credit, quite deservedly, for being the one who finally really stood up and used the power of television to go after McCarthy. And he did it at great risk to his own career. His employer, CBS, was not really happy about this, but he was quite forthright. And he, made sure that his case was airtight. One of the things that makes him stand out is that so many other reporters didn't do this. And, to be clear, some did, but many found it very hard to wrestle with McCarthy in particular, because McCarthy was a master manipulator, and he knew how to get the press to say what he wanted them to say. And for a long time, it was simply too tempting not to print whatever he said, because that drew eyeballs. But there was a debate among journalists for several years in the 1950s about how do we cover a guy like McCarthy, who's clearly lying and who clearly is not a good actor, and yet he is a sitting senator. How do we deal with this? And there were several sort of best practice sheets put out and debates about how do we deal with this, but not enough. And so it stands out that finally Murrow was the one who did what no one else was quite willing to say, and with a platform that got millions of Americans to pay attention.
And what about civil liberties? Can you talk about how they were infringed upon and how the courts might have stepped in or didn't?
Yeah, well, that's another part of the story, is that for a large chunk of the Red Scare, the courts at all levels were pretty much willing to step aside and let other branches of government have their will. And so, whether it's the executive or Congress, these were moments when you had no real judicial review, or the courts essentially said, this is a moment of emergency, and we need to be willing to sacrifice some civil liberties in the name of security. And, not everyone believed that, but, I'd say way too many. And groups that should have stepped up, like the American Bar Association, American Civil Liberties Union, did not cover themselves in glory during this time. I think they learned their lesson, and one of the reasons they became so important is because of what they didn't do during the Red Scare. And it was ultimately the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Earl Warren, who arrived in 1953, who began systematically to push back against the Red Scare, sort of culminating in a series of decisions in 1957 that dismantled a lot of the architecture of the Red Scare and declared that there were limits to what red baiting could achieve. But it took a long time. And I think, again, it's one of these things where eventually the courts, like the media, got the right answer, but at great cost from their delay.
Harvard and higher education are in the news a lot today. Can you talk about both Harvard and higher education, how they factored into the Red Scare back then?
Yeah, it's not coincidental that Harvard was under attack from McCarthy and other senators in the early 1950s, just like it is today. It's a symbol of the elite and the establishment. It's also a place where a lot of the people who filled out the top ranks of the White House or the executive branch, the New Deal, a lot of them went to Harvard or in one way or the other. And so it was a very attractive target. Higher education generally was a target, both at the federal level and also at the state level. These were places that, you know, were built on and increasingly in the mid-1900s, you know, were premised on the idea of academic freedom, of freedom of speech, of diversity of ideas. These were real values that the universities were trying to inculcate in their students. And, you know, starting in the 30s, a lot of those students had turned to the left. And so by the late 40s and 50s, it sort of becomes this very clear target for people looking for spies or some sort of subversion. And, you know, this is important, not just because it's one more place where people were potentially subversive or were accused of being subversives, but it's also, you know, highlights how important education is as a battleground culturally and politically in the United States. This is the place where we shape the next generation of ideas. And it's where at the university level, where a lot of our current debates are hashed out. And so if you want to control the narrative and you want to control the future course of ideas in America, you go after universities. And that's what happened during the Red Scare. And of course, I think inarguably that's what's happening today.
And so what brings the Red Scare and McCarthyism to an end?
So I think partly it's, you know, I mean, I hate to say it sort of peters out because it's not just that. But I think eventually it became clear to a lot of people that there was simply nothing, there was no there there. There really weren't, by the time of the Red Scare, pretty much all espionage was over. Most of it took place in the 30s and early 40s. The Communist Party was a tiny husk of what it had been. There was really nothing there. And most of the people who could have been, who might have been targeted had been targeted and they were in jail. But it also, you know, and then the Cold War largely sort of simmered down. Joseph Stalin died. The Korean War ended. But I think it's also important that there was a real pushback from, you know, people like Murrow and people like Chief Justice Warren and, you know, a number of senators and congressmen who finally did stand up and sort of declare a line and make clear that while they were not pro-communist, they were opposed to what was going on. What was this, this sort of tearing apart of American society? And it's, it's cold comfort to say that eventually they persuaded people because it took a long time for that to happen. And there was a lot of damage in between.
Can you talk about the reporting process? I know in the 90s, there were a lot of papers that became declassified related to this time. Can you talk about the importance of those papers and how you went about reporting this book?
Yeah. So one of the other reasons I wanted to write the book is that, you know, there hadn't really been a comprehensive history of the Red Scare written since those papers came out. And, you know, they largely, you know, supported the claims of anti-communists that there had been subversion and espionage in the U.S. government. And so I wanted to write a history that took on both sides, that accounted for the fact that, yes, we now know that some of the figures like the Rosenbergs or Alger Hiss were most likely spies, and that these were facts that you have to deal with if you're trying to tell an accurate story of the Red Scare. And, you know, so for me, going back through all of this and sort of trying to weigh all of this evidence, first of all, to get all of it and then to weigh it was the primary challenge for the book.
And so we've just laid out what this time period was like politically and culturally. Knowing what you know about the Red Scare, do you think we're in another scare today?
I think there are a lot of elements of the Red Scare that you can see paralleled today. There are a lot of differences too. And one of the great things about history is that it teaches us not just to look for parallels, but to look for differences. So I think the demonization of minority and let's say, you know, outside groups of vulnerable groups. That was a common trope during the Red Scare. That's happening today. The demonization of progressive groups, you know, whether it's labor or civil rights or, you know, you name it. And they're different today in some ways than they were in the 50s, but it's the same tactic. Going after education and declaring that there is a war in education and that our children are being abused intellectually. This is another trope. The claim of there being this elite inside the government or inside society that is secretly undermining the American way. That's the same thing as we saw during the 1950s, and we see it today. You know, I think that the difference is that during the Red Scare, there was at least some premise of a justification. You know, there really was a Cold War going on. The Soviets really were geopolitical rivals who were trying to undermine us from within. You know, that's a legitimate concern. Today, there's nothing like that. And you know, to see what's going on in Los Angeles, for example, this idea that there's some insurrection going on, well, that's, you know, very similar to the kind of hyperbole that you saw during the Cold War. But there's nothing, it would be laughable, I think, if it weren't, you know, so dangerous to make these claims that are wholly unsupported by the facts.
And I think what really echoes, at least for me, is this chilling of free speech on the part of private businesses, afraid almost to speak up.
Yeah, that's another good point. Again, very similar to the Red Scare. You know, the blacklist was not a government policy. The blacklist was wholly the policy of studios, but also private businesses across industry. I mean, all sorts of industries that took seriously the idea that someone who wanted to be a shopkeeper or, you know, run a grocery store needed to be vetted for loyalty. You know, this sort of ridiculousness. But, you know, there was a real fear on the part of corporations that they would be on the wrong side of that debate, that they would be the target of protests or government action. It's no different today. And in some ways that's, you know, I'd say in some ways that it might be a little comforting in that we tend to go through these things, but it's also very disturbing having gone through all this as a writer and, you know, looking at all of this and saying, gosh, you know, we don't seem to learn our lessons as a country.
You can read more about all of this in Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.